Welcome back to the Doctor Who Flashcast. After a long absence of Doctor Who and of this podcast, we are back, regenerated, rejuvenated, and ready for new Doctor Who. I'm Jason Snell, host of some podcasts about things on the incomparable, and I am joined by the they're not the time team, they're the Doctor Who Flashcast team. We'll just call it that way. Chip Sutter, who hosts the 2 Minute Time Lord podcast, is also on the Doctor Who Flashcast. Hi, Chip.
Hey, Jason. It's great to be back on multiple levels. It's great to have Doctor Who back, and it's great to be podcasting with 2MTL again.
It's great to have you here too, and of course, you may know her from many podcasts, including in the Doctor Who variety, Verity, which is also regenerating and rejuvenating. It's Erica Ensign. Hi, Erica.
Hello. Yeah, like full-on kind of regeneration, changing it up for Verity. But so, I won't be on Verity this week, but I'm here instead, mm-hmm. So it's exciting.
It's good to have Erica in. I feel like we have Erica in what they call in Hollywood second position, which is like, you know, she's not going to be on every Verity. And we can get her mm-hmm. and grab her. I mean, that's what I always used to do with Liz Miles, is like, Liz, when are you not on Verity and available? Just to take the scraps where I can.
But I'm happy to be your scraps, Jason.
We met because of, I guess you're Verity scraps, but that's okay. Ooh. That you chewed up by the Verity machine, and then sometimes I'm just down there with a little scrap catcher. We met.
This is starting to go
Verity,
into a place.
So it is. It is. I'm grateful to Verity because that's how I know who Erica Ensign is.
Yeah, that's true. It's
from way back. The Star Beast. I'll just shout the Woo. Name of the episode. That'll be a thing that we won't repeat. The 60th anniversary of Doctor Who happened. They released a color episode of the Daleks that I find hilarious. Its runtime is what, 1/7 the runtime of the original.
Yeah,
story.
75 minutes.
Gotta love it. Gotta love that. That like says it all about 60s Doctor Who pacing. And I'm not disparaging 60s Doctor Who. I'm just saying 60s Doctor Who
times
pacing versus modern TV pacing. Fascinating.
I don't know. I think they sped it up too much, but that's just me.
I haven't watched it yet. I'm sure that a lot of things got cut and thrown in the bin in order to get it in there. But we're not here.
We
to
will
talk
all
about,
have notes.
We're not here to talk about the color Daleks. That's a different thing. We're here to talk about the Star Beast, the return of everything to Doctor Who from the past. It's also the beginning of the future. That I think that's the most interesting, outside the story itself, the most interesting thing about this whole thing that's happening now is this is the, you know, they announced it more than a year ago, the regeneration of Doctor Who. Depending on what metadata service you use, it's Doctor Who 2023 instead of Doctor Who 2005. It's like it's a whole new third iteration of the show. Mm-hmm. But it is old and new because it is not only the beginning of something that will lead to Shudigatwa being the next star of the show, but a weird interregnum between Jodie Whittaker and Shudigatwa where we have David Tennant and Catherine Tate back. So it's old and new. What's borrowed? Because the TARDIS is blue. We're almost there for the 60th anniversary. I don't know who's getting married.
Is it fair to say that Disney Plus borrowed Doctor Who?
Ah, there you go. We got it. We nailed it. It's all. Did you guys have the same thought? I felt like I was holding in my heart simultaneously the idea that this is new and a renewal of Doctor Who, and at the same time, kind of like I'm watching a reunion special.
It's,
I think I was only thinking about it as a reunion special, which is probably bad of me, but that's the crusty old fangirl. But no, you're right. It's it is also new, and it showed. It was old. It felt very old, but it looked very new. Thank you, Disney Plus, for letting us borrow all that money.
Thanks for the money.
Yeah, I think there was somewhere in an interview with Russell T. Davis, or maybe in his column in Doctor Who magazine, he said something about Disney really kicking in the marketing and the promotion when Shudigatwa takes over. And that makes a lot of sense, and it makes me think of these specials as really the prologue to an entirely new era. So you're getting some familiar faces, and you're getting, you know, continuations of old storylines, and it is a complete nostalgia trip. And I think it's just basically setting the table so that there's some awareness among like Disney Plus subscribers for, hey, there's this Doctor Who thing. That when the big marketing push comes out, you know, I'm repeating myself, but the table's already been set and people are paying attention.
It's weird that I kind of like the fact that this is a brand new era of Doctor Who. Like, this is all you get on Disney, at least for the time being. But I do feel like it is a weird place to start. So, yes, this is the beginning of Doctor Who 2023. But at the same time, like, I can't imagine telling somebody, yeah, you're new to Doctor Who, you should start with this episode. That throws back to the previous one. I saw on Mastodon yesterday or
15
something,
years but, ago in the previous one.
Yes, right. Yeah. So, like, I saw on Mastodon, I think it was yesterday, that somebody asked, I'm going to say friend of the show, Alex Cox, what they thought was a good place to start. And their answer, the correct answer, was the 11th hour. Mm-hmm. And while I agree with that, I feel like the second best place to start is this Christmas. Just jump in with the new Doctor. And I would not tell somebody to start here.
No.
And a part of that is because of the necessity for the very beginning of this episode, which is this weird little 2-minute, here's what's happening, which Rachel Talalay wanted to make clear she had nothing to do with. Mm. And I knew she had nothing to do with it just watching it because I was like, this doesn't seem right.
Can we call it Once Upon a 2-Minute Time Lord?
maybe
we can't. Oh, we can't. No, and we will talk about.
Hey, if it gives me more listeners, okay. Absolutely.
It
is an interesting choice, and I swear we were going to talk about the episode, but there is also, I mean, like, we do talk about the meta at the end of the Jodie Whittaker era. I feel like most of what we talked about was the meta around the show, but I think it's important because, you know, when we do all those flashcasts about like the Christmas special, I always say to people, look, it's a Christmas special. It's got a job to do. And Russell T. Davis elaborated this back in 2006, 2005, that, you know, it's people who just had their Christmas turkey and now they're sitting down in front of the TV to watch Doctor Who and they may not watch it otherwise. And you want it to be big and keep them awake and have it be fun for the whole family. Here, it's not quite that, but it's real close, which is it's the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who. And what do you do? And then from his standpoint, he's like, I'm sure there were scheduling things, but it's also like introducing a new doctor who nobody's ever seen before for the 60th seems wrong. I remember thinking about that with the 50th, where they sort of extended Matt Smith for a couple specials in order to get to Peter Capaldi, because celebrating with telling a new doctor story is probably not ideal. And so I feel like this is a weird interregnum, because I think Russell T. Davis rightly decided, here's what we're going to do. We're going to play to the past and have a big happy send-off for that era and for David and Catherine by doing this, it turns out, instead of one special, three special episodes around the 60th that will lead into the Christmas special and lead into the new era. But like, that we can't put Shudigatwa on the spot in episode one on the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who. And so we're going to be left with a 3 or 4 episode weird interregnum thing that is, which I had a blast. I loved it. But yeah, it's not the beginning. This is the end of an era more than it is a beginning. It's like putting a button on 2005 era before we step into the future.
I think you're right about that, Jason, but the reason that this doesn't feel, it's an interregnum, but it doesn't feel weird to me because, and I'm probably the one person of the three of us who is the biggest apologist for the Chibnall era, but the number of people that I know who, oh my God, I can be excited about Doctor Who again. Doctor Who is back. Oh my God, we've finally turned a corner. I think in some ways that's the reason that these three specials exist, because Chibnall was a lot of things, good and bad, but his Doctor Who was kind of medium cool, as I said in my last podcast, and RTD stuff is blazing hot. Big feelings, big emotions, grabbing for attention. And you do that and you bring back probably still the most beloved modern doctor.
I think so.
And you just build this ocean of goodwill from probably the vast majority of current Doctor Who fans, and you get people happy about Doctor Who again, and then you introduced a new Doctor Who. If you've seen the end of the re-edit of An Adventure in Space and Time, I'm just so excited about what's going to come after these specials. That man oozes charisma.
Yeah, it's a tough thing, but it's been fun, and I look forward. I actually love the idea too that it is like a little mini season that we're getting with three hour long episodes, so they can have a cliffhanger at the end. That's they set up Donna spilling her coffee, and she gets fired from her job.
Yeah, that was.
And she just says, seems extraneous at the time that there's a coffee maker here, and that's what got me fired from the job. But it leads to a, I thought, very funny joke that is the ultimate Russell T. Davis mixture of domesticity with wild science fiction is the TARDIS burst into flame because Donna spilled coffee on it. It's great.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And we get a cliffhanger for next week, which is great.
Yeah, so I guess this means we're moving from the meta to the fiction?
I mean, was it subtle? But I thought, well, I mean, it is meta in the sense that we're talking about the fact that it's not a special, it's not a one-off, that he got the funding and the support from BBC and Disney and everybody else. But I will tie it up in a bow, which is I agree with both of you that, like, in the end, I don't think it makes sense to do your big rollout of marketing for this, because it is not the big moment. The big moment is the Christmas special and the launch of the first season. And that's okay. Like, this is the 60th celebration essentially going on here. And we get the other thing to mention is, I don't know whether Russell T. Davis has spent the last 15 years thinking about or hearing the criticism of the way he handled Donna's exit. Although I suspect that given that he stuck her in his last episode as a little footnote, that he was already trying to make amends. I don't know, or whether he just thought, oh, this opportunity arose and David and Catherine want to come back and maybe I can take this story a little bit further and wrap things up. But like in a lot of fandom, the mind wiping of Donna Noble is the fundamental like sin committed by Russell T. Davis. And it's fascinating to see that he's taking this episode in particular to undo it, to fix it at last.
Yeah, but we'll get there. But he doesn't ever apologize. And
no,
I'm still waiting for that apology.
No, I mean, maybe he'll apologize at some point for what he did. I think the truth is he thought that it was very dramatic and very tragic. And since Catherine Tate was leaving the show, that's what he did. In fact, I think if there's any apology to be granted at all, it is in that final scene where she says, "Hey, why does it have to be the big dramatic goodbye? Why can't you just pop over for a cup of tea every now and then, and we don't have to do this thing anymore?" And I thought, well, that is kind of a meta commentary on the way companions leave, because the actors leave, and so the companions leave. But otherwise, no. Although I do appreciate the fact that I saw somebody criticizing the sort of like expediency of the resolution of the plot of this episode, and I thought, well, in many ways he left his silly plot device laying on the table for 15 years, which is the meta crisis and everything that went, and the Dr. Donna, and it felt to me very much like the same author of that literally just picked up that plot device and said, oh, there are a few more things that I can do with the meta crisis is sort of it's a silly plot device anyway. So it's really the creator of it came back to extend it further. And that's what we get at the end of the episode, is more meta crisis talk. And I am happy to go with it, because there's that moment where, oh, I forget what it is. They're like releasing the gravity stanchions or something, somebody says.
Brandish stanchions.
The gravity stanchions, yes, because the verb also has to be wacky. And I thought, oh, it's Russell. He's back.
Yeah.
It so was.
On top of that, you know, The moment that I knew that RTD himself was back was when the unit soldiers are storming the steelworks and they're shouting orders at each other that make absolutely no sense. You would, you know, and it's so overwrought. And I remembered, oh, wait a minute. This is the guy who had the president-elect of the United States addressing the Tokla thing. Russell T. Davis is big, maybe camp, absolutely pulling your leg and inside on and in on the joke. And he is not afraid of just being anything but subtle. And I think that that's the, I think that that is his hallmark in this one. And when he did that stuff with the Meeps orders and the unit soldiers and things like that, one of the best things about it is it's telling new audiences exactly what kind of show this is and not pretending that it's like Loki from the MCU or something like that. It's for a family audience. It's big and silly, and you got to be down with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like the techno babble, which isn't even techno babble, it's techno statements.
Yes.
That it felt so Russell T. Davis. Yeah, between that and just the, you know, unapologetically, you know, everybody used to talk about the queer agenda back in his original days. Now it's just like, yep, this is that guy. He is unapologetic about it, and I love that.
Yeah. So how did you both feel about the resolution to Donna's story? So we talked about, like, it's not an apology, but I do wonder whether he keeps thinking that he could fix it up to be a little bit better, or whether he decided, you know what, after 15 years, why does it have to be a tragic story? Why can't I get a happy ending here? And so that's what he does. The thingamajig that he uses is that now that Donna has a daughter, that the energy has gone into the daughter in part, and that my favorite moment in the whole thing is the revelation that not only does she give herself when she transitions, she gives herself the name Rose, but she also is using that shed that is inspired by the TARDIS, and all of her little creations that she's making out there are inspired by creatures from Doctor Who's past. By the way, if you haven't watched it a second time, when the first creature is revealed, please note that it is the Beast from the two-parter.
The Beast Below.
Impossible Planet.
Impossible Planet Satan Pit.
And yes,
Satan,
thank you.
Pit. It is the Beast from the Satan Pit as a cute little thing. So all of that, the idea that it's been there all along, and that allows him to have, I think, a nice little twist, which is, well, actually, Donna's daughter is the reason that Donna doesn't have to die immediately upon Metacrisis, and that it's all connected, and that somehow that this moment of getting the power into them and then removing it is kind of a healing moment where Rose understands her place in the universe a little bit better, and they're both sort of connected to the Doctor, but also healed. I wonder what you both thought of that, because it is like the big overarching from 15 years ago, picking up a plot point and trying to leave these characters in a different place.
Well, like I said, I was hoping for an actual apology as opposed to just, you know, fixing it. But you know, that could still happen, or maybe it won't, because in the beginning, like when in Journey's End, when Donna left, I at first kind of just like fell for it and went along with it and was like, oh my God, this is so sad. I cried and cried, and I was just, you know, upset, but I understood. And as I sort of, you know, went on into my fandom and talked to more people, I found people who were righteously outraged by it, because it was such a violation of her, you know, of Donna's agency. She wanted to die as the person that she was and not right. become the person she had been. And I hadn't thought about it like that. Like, it had never occurred to me. And when I thought about it, I was like, oh yeah, you know, this is a terrible thing that the Doctor did. But I have always said that Doctor, as written, he would never do anything differently. So, you know, it was one of those things where the fault just lies with RTD for making that choice to have the story end in that way, because there's no way that 10th Doctor would have done anything different at that point. So, you know, I was kind of not pleased with it as a plot choice, but I was fine with the Doctor having done it because it led up there. You know, Watsonian versus Doylist interpretations of that particular beat. When I found out Donna was coming back, I was like, well, okay, he's gonna not necessarily undo it, but he's probably going to fix it. And that's exactly what he did here. And I think that the way that he did it was lovely. I know I was a little bit confused about the binary, non-binary thing because, you know, when you get into it, there are trans people who consider themselves non-binary. There are some who don't. So, like, it was a little bit muddy there, but the fact that there was representation at all just made me really happy. And the idea that Donna passes this on, and like you said, that Rose has all these memories that she, you know, is subconsciously turning into toys in the TARDIS as a shed. I thought all of that worked really well. I thought it was tying it all up into a nice bow and ending. I thought, you know, it was like an elegant way to make that landing. And whether or not this, you know, this version of the 10th Doctor, the 14th Doctor, ever comes to a place where he recognizes, oh, that thing that I did to you wasn't just bad because you gave away 166 million pounds. It was also bad because I violated your trust and your right. agency and didn't let you make the choice for yourself. I don't know that he will actually get to that point. And I kind of don't care in terms of this episode, because I think the way that it all worked out in this episode made sense within the fictional universe that RTD has built over the years. So I was quite pleased with it.
If I think real hard, I would say that the moment that the opportunity was when the Doctor says, it killed me to do that. Mm-hmm. He's not apologizing. He's like, it was really bad. But if I work real hard, what I would say is he, in that moment in the spaceship where they're separated by the partition, just like he was with Wilf, which is a nice callback. He, mm-hmm. says, he basically gives her the opportunity, right? First he says,
yeah,
if I do this, you die. And she's like, yes, but I would be saving my daughter and millions of people, and I want to do it. And then she gets that moment where she maybe unknowingly but partially knowingly accepts that, and then she becomes the metacrisis Donna, Dr. Donna again, and shows no regret. Like, I'm glad I'm doing this. It's the best 58 seconds of my life and all of that. So in the text, you could make the argument that the Doctor gets a do-over and this time allows her to make her sacrifice. But again, he's the one allowing her to make her sacrifice. So I can see both sides of it.
And it's all about him. It killed me. It killed me. It killed me. Yeah, it killed you.
Oh, which is also
so self-absorbed.
Which is also very 10th Doctor and honestly very RTD.
Yeah.
A couple of things there is, at least at every stage from the partition going down to the end, Donna and Rose have complete agency for every decision that they make from that point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't read to me as an apology, but it does read as acknowledgement.
Yeah, like it's a better Russell of 15 years on. He's older. He is, I think, very much older and wiser, and has really changed as an artist, seeing some of the work he's done in between. And I do think that it's the ending today's Russell T. Davis would write. It's not an apology, but it is a better ending.
Yeah, Russell T. Davis is one of the things that I appreciate about him is that, you know, he's stubborn and. He's stubbornly assertive in what he thinks the right story is. You know, in the official podcast, he talks about the new TARDIS set, which I'm sure we'll get to. And he's like, you may not like it, but you're wrong. It's brilliant. You know, that's,
Ray.
That's
he's
a sentence that would never have come out of Chris Chibnall's mouth.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Chip, you had more thoughts about Donna, or was that the...
No, I'm good. Let's move on.
All right. Well, you mentioned the new TARDIS. Let's just talk about that. We're going like backward. Well, it's timey-wimey. Whatever.
Yeah.
We're going backward through the episode. But let's talk about the new TARDIS set. I think after the modern series has done a lot of dimly lit you know, things of coral or gears or other things like that, to have it be... real throwback to the 80s, I would say, or even the classic, but I got a real 80s vibe from that console, too. The idea of bright white, the round things are back, and there are lots of ramps everywhere, which is maybe a certain unit technical advisor will appear as well. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of ramps. David Tennant does a lap, which I thought was maybe a little too self-congratulatory. Let me run through our entire expensive set. But it's fine. It's fine. It was beautiful.
It was
the music is swelling. It was all really nice. And all those lights are individually controlled so that they can have that they swirl and change color depending on the mood of the TARDIS. Yeah, it was pretty spectacular. It's not that old show. It's very much a look. We do have money, and this will be Shudikatwa's control room as well. So like we're investing for the long haul in this thing. So I'm going to start with Erica because Erica has already expressed delight.
I'm so excited! This is my new favorite TARDIS interior of all time. It was just instantaneous. I did not see, there was a little like 7-second leaked video of it that somebody took on their phone. I had not seen that. So this reveal was completely fresh to me. And it was like the 80s style overly lit, except this time it's not overly lit, white TARDIS interior, but inside a disco ball that can also do colors. Yeah. It was just like, this has been made specifically for me. And I have to say, I loved David Tennant running around because when you think about, yes, he's the older version of this doctor, but you know that guy when he walks in for the first time, of course he's going to run a lap. Like if he didn't, I would feel like there was something wrong with him. And I have seen somewhat conflicting versions of whether or not that was David Tennant's idea or Rachel Talalay's idea. He said it was Rachel Talalay's idea in the InVision commentary. But to me, it was just like, you're both geniuses when it comes to Doctor Who, so that makes perfect sense. But then I guess he had to plan a route to be able to be like, this is the way I'm going to go so that she could actually film it. And I think I'm super excited to see if there are any changes between this and the Shudigatwa era. Like, obviously, this is the set, but it's very big in empty. It feels kind of like a cave. Right. Like, are we going to fill it in with you know, shelves or wardrobe? Because Shudigatwa's doctor apparently has a lot of costumes. So the central console is bigger. Yes, it has a coffee maker now, which is hilarious. My headcanon is that the TARDIS included that coffee maker specifically so that Donna would have a cup of coffee to spill on the console, because the TARDIS needs to take, you know, it's going to take the doctor where they need to be as opposed to where they want to go. So, I'm in love. I am absolutely in love. Apparently, those individual colored circles, you can like spell words and stuff. That's what the producer was saying on the InVision commentary. So the TARDIS could be
smart bulbs,
very smart there. Mouth.
Yeah, I love it. Chip?
Yeah, TARDIS brought to you by Philips Hue. I really like the TARDIS as well. Not quite as in love with it as a lot of the folks I'm hearing from, but I really do like it. I have heard from a friend of a friend about people with mobility disabilities really liking it, feeling like this is the first TARDIS that they could imagine themselves being comfortable in. Or being
100%
even
sure
in.
that is the reason that it's designed the way it is, actually.
Yeah,
100%.
For some people, the sort of the feeling that it's sort of an 80s callback is the thing for them. And I'm sort of resisting that a little bit because my favorite TARDISes are the original 9th and 10th Doctor TARDIS and the second Matt Smith TARDIS. I like a certain amount of nooks and crannies and such, but I'm sure I'll warm to it because it's a big playground for directors and actors. So I imagine there's going to be all kinds of interesting stuff going on there.
Yeah. And the thing that Jason said that I'm super excited about is that now with the changing colors and stuff, the TARDIS can emote, you know, in a much more obvious sort of way. And it's also worth pointing out that the original TARDIS interior back in 1963 as designed, it was supposed to have the roundels lit up from behind. So that was a thing that was supposed to happen like from way back. That's the point of having them there, but it was too expensive and too difficult to do. So they didn't do that, but they still kept the round things and they just sort of have continued on. So it's kind of like here we are on the 60th anniversary of that very first episode of Doctor Who, and we finally have the roundels lighting up in the way, kind of the way that they were supposed to all that time ago. It's really lovely.
Miss the round things. What do they do? No idea.
They just look cool.
No idea. I wonder a little bit if having built a first Doctor-ish TARDIS interior during the Stephen Moffat era and using it for Adventure in Space and Time and various episodes with the first Doctor and various episodes where other TARDISes were stolen from Gallifrey, they used that a bunch. And then I think they used pieces of it with John Hurt too, along with pieces of the of David Tennant's TARDIS. So like I wonder if having it be present in recent memory maybe a little twigged a little bit among the people working on the new Doctor Who of like, oh,
Can confirm that RTD said in the most recent official Doctor Who podcast that was very much on his mind, that all of the he directly cited Clara and Mi's TARDIS the John Hurt TARDIS and such, and said it's time to go back to that. It's time for that 80s throwback.
Well, inspiration, because in 2005 they were like, we're going to reinvent this thing and it's going to be organic and it's going to have the big coral and the beams and all of that. And it's like, well, that
and
was great.
They reinvented dirty.
Dirty. And so that we get that line, which is like, oh, yeah, it was kind of dirty. Lauren laughed out loud at that line, by the way. I think it's time, right? And that is a theme of a lot of this. It's like, in 2005, they reinvented Doctor Who. Well, it's 2023 and they have to reinvent Doctor Who again, and some of that is going to be maybe looking past 2005 for inspiration, because now it's a change to go back and not just follow the path of 2005. It's fascinating. I agree. Yeah, I look forward to seeing how they use it. They spent a lot of money on it. The lights are great. I love that the first thing David Tennant does when he runs onto the set is throw his coat over the railing. So good. All right, back up from there. Let's talk about the Meep. Can we talk about the Meep? Yeah. I vaguely remember the Meep from, I think they reprinted the Starbeast comic from Doctor Who Weekly in the Marvel 80s. Chip, do you remember this? The Marvel 80s Doctor Who comics?
I remember those comics, but I don't remember what was in them.
It was Tom Baker stuff, and I think it was... I think this was in there. Maybe I'm misremembering, and it's just sort of seeped in, because I definitely had those comics. But regardless... I think really interesting that this episode is even credited as being inspired by the Doctor Who comic from that era, where there was a cute alien who was running from monsters who turns out to be the real monster. I'm not sure what is more Doctor Who than that, but I loved the Meep. When I saw the trailer, I was like, oh boy, Doctor Who, silly Doctor Who monster. But in the end, like, I thought it looked really good, and I thought the voice was great, and I thought the transformation from it being good to being evil was hilarious and awesome. And so I'm pro Meep. How about you? How does all hail the Meep or no?
All hail the Meep. my wife Shannon came in completely cold to this. She was not aware of the Meep's history in comics. So when the evil teeth got bared, she just hooted with laughter.
Nice.
Lauren said, it's too cute. I think it's bad.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
I was aware that, you know, the Star Beast was coming from the comics. I kind of expected, though, that this would actually be a continuation, that David Tennant would, his doctor would be like, oh my God, it's the Meep. You don't understand. It's evil. But I was surprised, actually, when watching it, that it was actually an adaptation of that story, just like, you know, several other TV episodes in the reboot have been adaptations of other source material. Love it. Love what it says. You know, it's tribbles who are intentionally homicidal. Is that kind of vibe?
Well, it's more like their son, right? Their son turned them evil. So they were these pleasant creatures. And the psychedelic son, like they're some great phrases around that too. Erica, all hail the Meep.
All hail the leader, all hail the Meep, or whatever it was.
Its pronouns are the definite article. I will be referred to as the Meep. Like, all right, the Meep.
Sure. I mean, I am too steeped in fandom to have been able to go in completely cold, because I've never read or even seen the comic, but I knew that it was being adapted from the comic, and I knew that the Meep was actually bad. But at the same time, I didn't know how faithful they were going to be to this adaptation. And I did think, I had heard it was an adaptation. So I was wondering, is the Meep actually going to be bad like it was in the original story? Or maybe they twist it around and RTD decides, no, we've got a good Meep here and we're going to roll with that. So, but honestly, like I was pretty sus through most of the beginning of it because I think Lauren was right. Like, it's too cute. It's trying too hard. And then, yes, when it flipped over to obviously being evil, maybe it was just like, I appreciate that it was, like you said, the fact that their son went insane and it caused all of the Meeps to become maniacs, which I thought was a kind of funny way to put it. Mm-hmm. And because it's so over the top. And sometimes I get a little bit annoyed with over the top Doctor Who villains because it's just like, oh my gosh, you're just chewing the scenery. And it's just, it's, have you no rational thought at all? And it's like, no, of course not, because your living son took over all of you. So this is the perfect excuse to just be absolute, the baddest of baddies, over the top, deciding who I'm going to eat first. Like, it was, I thought it was really delightfully fun. It took me, I was expecting the voice to be more cartoony than it was. So the first time it goes meep meep and it's Miriam Margolyes' voice going meep meep, I was like, oh, that sounds like a person saying meep meep, which it totally was. And so it took me a little while to get used to that because you have this adorable, perfect costume / CG character that sounds like it, you know, it's like somebody's voice saying meep meep. But once I got used to it, I was kind of fine with that. It was a little bit off-putting for a split second.
By the way, I can confirm that the 1984 Doctor Who monthly comic from Marvel Comics published in the U.S. did begin, in fact, with the Star Beast saga. Uh-huh. So I did read the Star Beast in 1984 in a Marvel comic. So that was
What an amazing story for the U.S. market to debut with.
Right? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. I think their thought process was the only people in the U.S., the only doctor people in the U.S. know is Tom Baker. So we're going to go hard on the Tom Baker doctor and lean into that. And they started with this. I got to mention the Roth Warriors, the bug men who are adorably just like the, I apologize.
Rubber suits.
I did not.
An upper crust.
Complete my mission. I'm very sorry. Like, adorable. They are very Doctor Who villains in that they look like something drawn out of a comic book. They really do. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, their eyes glow and they move a little bit. And like, that's your silly Doctor Who alien in this episode. But even then, I found it kind of charming. Like, the show knows exactly what these guys look like. They're cute.
And leans into it.
And not what you expect, right? Which is that moment. So the moment is David Tennant pulls a judge's wig out of somewhere and declares that it's a trial, which is a...
Just like Tom Baker did in the Stones of Blood.
See? It's a hilarious moment of a callback and a hilarious, very Doctor Who moment, I would say, where it's sort of like... And Russell gets to card out the Shadow Proclamation again, citing subsections 6 and J or whatever it is, which I really love.
P and 15.
Oh, 15 and P, but it's like
six,
it's a letter.
P and 15.
It's a letter and a number, which is just like... Of course, sure, just an extra bit of insanity to layer on what happens. Yep. But there is that moment right before that where he's in the car and he's like, well, yeah, we got away, or we've made a horrible mistake.
He shoots the most suspicious look over at the Meep. I have watched it 3 times now. So the second time I watched it, I noticed that look because I was like, my eyes were glued to David Tennant the first time I watched it. And I was like, you know, he says, unless we got things very, very wrong. And I was just like, oh, I bet he's suspicious. And the second time I was like, oh, he totally is. Cause he looks right at the Meep with this, furrows the brow.
Also, in another meta moment, the fact that they're turning the taxi around, Sean's taxi around, and it's fired on multiple times by the Warriors and it takes no damage. That's a very Doctor Who thing, right? Which is they have, or it's actually a very movie and TV thing, which is, well, these are our heroes. They have to get away. And so although they seem to be shooting up their car, but it didn't really do any damage. And then it immediately turns around and says, aha, no, actually that's a clue that it did no damage. Yep. That really nice, that whole little turn that leads to the Meep revealing its horrible, you know, fangs, teeth there is that's a really funny, very Doctor Who moment. And good David Tennant running around and doing his I guess, trademark kind of whiplash between being very serious and being very ridiculous in moments, which he does at several points in that scene. It's good stuff. I like it.
Yeah, in the InVision commentary, David, it's Phil Collins and the executive producer, and David Tennant, and one of the producers, I'm forgetting which one. But anyway, David Tennant is talking about how when he puts the wig on, it totally flattens his hair. And apparently, it just completely kills his hairdo. So the shot where he takes it off, he's like, that's a very quick cut indeed. And we rewound to watch it. And sure enough, like, his hair is just like, it's ridiculous. It's so flattened and messy. And then the next shot, it's back to being perfect because Time Lord hair, it's the best. Sure, I wish magic. We could all have it.
It regenerated. It's Vicky DeLeau, one of the producers of it. And
yes, yeah. She has great insights.
She's a new series producer. And then, of course, Phil Collinson was there back in 2005. And so it's adorable. It's, I think, a BBC only. I mean, I don't know how we got it.
Timey-wimey. I went in the future to when it was released on a DVD and watched it and came back. Ta-da!
Anyway, they're doing those instead of the old podcast commentaries from back in the day. And it is always amusing because David Tennant and Phil Collinson pull out their fan credentials that they both bought that issue of Doctor Who Weekly, and Phil Collinson didn't even rub the little transfer rub-on things.
Yes, he didn't peel them off.
He never did that, whereas David Tennant did it, but he did it exactly where you were supposed to.
Where they were told.
He says, there's something about us here. And then Vicky DeLeau is like, nerds, okay, let's move.
She's like, I'm just going to watch the episode. Like,
anyway, I don't know how we got that commentary and we're able to watch some of it, but I could tell you this. We just watched on Disney Plus worldwide and don't have to say something about getting it from a truck or anything. We just watched it, and that's kind of delightful. Shout out to Australians who are still burned by the fact that it used to be on free TV and now it isn't, but I'll tell you, as an American.
And to people in Ireland who can't watch it at all.
Who can't watch it because the BBC situation in Ireland is weird, right? Which is just par for the course with British and Irish relations. But for us in North America, aces, because it dropped the moment that the episode aired in the UK. Great.
It was weird. Just not having the stress of wondering, you know, if a truck was going to back up in time or if a VPN was going to work. It was like, this is relaxing almost.
I still didn't believe that it was going to be ready for me when I would log into Apple TV. Like, I turned off the Apple TV just to make sure. I turned it back on after 1:30 because I wasn't sure what would happen if I was still on between 1:29 and 1:30. You know, I am a Doctor Who fan. I'm used to expecting the worst and that things aren't going to work. And yet, I am part of a global community that can watch the whole thing instantly. There's no using other means. There's no hiding from social media. We were all part of it in real time, and I'm genuinely grateful for that. Obviously, BBC is first among equals, and this is a British show, but to be able to watch it at the same time, it's like, it's like an awful lot of healing ever since PBS viewers got to see the Five Doctors first.
The whole process that has had to happen to get us to this. But and when they did the simulcast on like BBC America, it was only to start, and then immediately there were commercials and it got stretched out further and further away from what was happening. And we don't have any of that. It's the first time since the PBS days where Doctor Who has aired in the US as it's intended. Which, unless you get the ad version of Disney Plus, I suppose they'll insert ads in there. But if for those of us who are paying for the full-on Disney Plus, it's just the show as it aired on the BBC, which is
almost. It's not exact.
Okay. What I guess Radio Free Scaro has the details because Stephen Shapansky does this, so we don't have to. Did they change the content?
It's only
or is
the opening
it just
credits.
The opening credits?
And the closing credits. Yeah, both of the opening and the closing credits. I actually spotted the difference in the opening credits because Steven started up the BBC version just to compare. And
say
yes,
more?
In the BBC version, you have a screen that has the three executive producers, Russell T. Davis, Phil Collinson, Julie Gardner, and also like another one. And then you go to the Rachel Talalay and I can't remember, one of the other producers. In the Disney Plus version, you don't get those. They're in the closing credits only.
Oh, interesting.
And some of the closing credits have like a bunch of the text on one line for the Disney version, and it's on two lines for the BBC version, or vice versa. I don't know. There's pictures. If you look at the Radio Free Scaro live stream on YouTube, there are actually, like, Stephen puts up the pictures to compare. He did screen grabs, but it's only that. Like, they didn't screw up the aspect ratio like BBC America always did. They showed it in a different aspect ratio than you did on the BBC. That's the same. All of it, everything else is the same. It just seems to be and the very, very end where there's the four production credits, as you know, Bad Wolf and BBC for Disney and BBC Studios, or I'm flipping that around, but they're in a different order on the BBC version. And I suspect it's some sort of rights or legal reasons that they have to adjust those things. But the show itself is the same, which was a huge relief.
Yeah, that's good. I do wonder if there are some specific crediting rules in the UK as a UK production that internationally Disney Plus doesn't have to follow, and that's the reason.
Could be. Mm-hmm.
It's funny because, I mean, they wouldn't do it if there weren't a reason, because it's extra work. But
exactly.
Yep. I'll also point out, like, because this is a Disney Plus production, if you wait till the end, you will see all of the international subtitle credits.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is an international streaming show, and so they've had it subtitled in all of the languages for everyone everywhere. And I mean, all the ones that are supported by Disney Plus, but like
subtitles or dubs?
Are there dubs?
Dubs.
Are they?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's subtitles too, but I saw somewhere that there are dubs.
They're
using different at least in some countries, they're using different actors than the previous versions.
Yeah, well, that does happen.
That would be a little weird.
But it is, it's a full on, so dubs and subs and descriptive audio, and we'll throw in, it's an HDR. Was it ever an HDR before? I don't know.
Mm.
Not the ones that I saw on the truck anyway. So this is quite a thing. Looks great. Looks modern. That opening title sequence. Russell T. Davis, when he started, was like, let's bring back the time tunnel from Tom Baker and kind of do it up. And it's been riffed on and then replaced, and it's been in all these different versions. And here it's like, let's do the time tunnel, but with a camera that's flying around, like panning
like
and
Superman
zooming
returns
and following the TARDIS in and all. Like, it's pretty wild. What did you guys think?
I like it. I kind of missed the profile or portrait of the current doctor being integrated in there somewhere.
Oh my god.
They brought that back, and then
Russell was like, no, we're not doing that.
Oh god, thank god. No offense, dear.
Again.
Chip. I just thought that's too much.
No offense taken. Offense totally taken.
How dare you?
I feel like for me, that would have been a step too far. Give me my 80s TARDIS, but I do not want some giant face in my
face,
opening
flying
credits.
Face.
I was glad that was gone.
So you didn't like it with Capaldi or Smith?
No, I really didn't. I laughed at it and I appreciated it as like a little haha. Here's a little bit of a throwback, but it wasn't something that I actually. It did not feel modern at all. It really felt like this is for the ancient fans, which usually I'm up for, but for some reason in that case I wasn't. I love the time tunnel. It's like smoky and like it's made out of, I don't know, cotton candy or something.
Yeah.
It looks cool, but it's still the tunnel. And I do appreciate that the camera is moving. And I really did. I mean, because on The Incomparable, we recently did all of the Superman movies. I really got a very strong Superman Returns vibe because it was the giant credits coming at me and the camera moving around them. And I was just this is, but it's great. It felt really vibrant and exciting. And the one big complaint that I have seen was from Steven that the logo just sort of pops in almost from nowhere. It doesn't feel like it's organically sort of added in there, but it disappears very nicely. And I hadn't really realized that until he pointed it out. And I'm like, yeah, okay. But I'm wondering if that will change for the Shuri Gatwa era. Like maybe they won't do an entirely new time tunnel for the opening credits, but the way that the logo appears, and you know what? I might make an exception for Shudigatwa's face winking at me if he winks. Right. If he winks, I'm in.
There you go.
Inconsistent, but
I still think you're a heretic, Erica. But I'm going to admit to heresy in a few minutes, though. So we're Ooh. Even. But I do agree. I really love the opening, the title credits. I do think it was especially needed this time around because the prologue that Rachel Talalay did not shoot looked very cheap, and we needed something that looked like it had Disney money behind it ASAP.
Previously on Doctor Who is what that 2-minute, not mm-hmm. Time Lord. I mean, I know why it's there, right? It is. In fact, this is funny. I don't know if you've noticed this on other things, but every now and then, it's like, you know how they did the Star Wars Special Edition? Sorry, I'm sorry to go there, but they did the Star Wars Special Edition, and there's that extra scene where Han meets Jabba the Hutt, and mm-hmm. everything in that scene is stuff that is in dialogue with Han meeting Greedo. It's very clear that they cut that scene and moved the dialogue. And I point that out, and there's some other instances I could get to, but like I point that out because it's clear from the rest of this episode mm-hmm. that all the points made in the prologue are made in the episode to explain the backstory. It's all in there. They tell it again. And yet, yeah. at some point, somebody got worried that it was... that people were not going to be patient enough to be told that information and there should be a download at the top. Is that download dramatic and artful and shows a bunch of clips from old Doctor Who? It's like, sure, I get why it's there, but it, mm-hmm. as somebody who doesn't need it, it doesn't need to be there.
You know what? I'm okay with it existing. I just wish that somebody had foreseen that need earlier. I recognize that, yeah, I think RTD and did a good job of writing it into the script so that you, as a viewer, you will learn it as it goes. But I also am not at all surprised that some executive, either at the BBC or Bad Wolf or Disney Plus, just said, hey, no, we need something more. Because I feel like it felt very much tacked on as a last minute thing. I feel like if they mm-hmm. had thought of it earlier, they could have done something a little bit more elegant with it. Instead, it feels very cheap and tacked on and last minute. And I feel like it's probably a good helpful thing to have for people who, you know, start up Disney Plus and go, hey, what's this tile? I'm going to try watching Doctor Who with the very first Doctor Who that I have, and it's this. I mean, it's good to give them something, but I just wish that we had something better to give them than
yeah,
that.
It should. It's an episode that had Rachel Talalay's name on it, and it had that leading off with it, and yep. that's a little cringeworthy. Although I don't know that this would have been gone out to test audiences or anything else like that, but
I think it may not
have been a suit. It may have been just some normal Disney Plus customer in a test audience saying, I don't get it.
I don't know. It also may just be that the production team rethought it when they screened it back and were worried. But I do totally think it could be somebody from the BBC saying, I'm concerned that mm-hmm. you know, that people aren't going to remember what happened 15 years ago or didn't see it. And that you're doing it subtly here as we go. And I'm concerned people are going to tune out. So you need to grab them by the lapels right at the beginning and say, why are you wearing a suit jacket that's inappropriate for this environment? Why these lapels? Take that jacket off. But also, let's remember what happened 15 years ago. So it is, yeah, it doesn't feel very organic. I get why it's there. I almost wanted and looked for the, you know, skip recap button. mm-hmm. Disney Plus, like, can we just skip the recap? But it's done more artfully than that. But it's to the camera. I don't know.
That's what I hate. I don't like that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, well, I guess, like, what else? Like, they did the artful version of it. It's in the actual show. And then they're like, nope. And it's not like the Doctor has somebody to talk to. Like, you could write it as a scene, but you can't because he would be speaking into space anyway, talking to himself. And so instead, we're left with what we got. It's not the worst thing in the world, but it is a very weird thing. It's very weird.
Do you have time for me to confess my heresy, Jason?
Yes, please. That's why we tuned in here, right? Erica All right. and I cannot wait for this, I think. Mm-hmm.
So I am a person who posted fan art after the old Andre the Giant has a posse sketches that were circulating around like 20 years ago.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but sure.
Yeah, I published fan art that got reproduced on Twitter a few times of Murray Gold has a posse. Loved Murray Gold. His entire runs in for RTD and Stephen Moffat. I also loved Sagan Akinola. I am disappointed that Murray Gold is back. Hmm. Honestly, I didn't want to stick with Sagan Akinola. I wanted somebody entirely new scoring the show. I actually was disappointed when I heard familiar themes. I know why it's there. I mean, I guess you couldn't get away with bringing the whole band together without bringing the whole band back together, literally. Murray Gold's music was just a little too familiar for me this time around, and I figure that I'm going to be getting reused to him for years to come. At this point,
you know what, Chip? I will be interested to follow up with you after we get to the Shudigatwa era.
That's it.
Because I feel like Murray Gold, he knows what he's doing, and he's doing familiar on purpose because that's what this is. This is a reunion special. And I don't really notice the music that way, but Stephen pointed out, like, there's the I Am the Doctor theme, except yeah. it's in 4/4 time instead of 7/8 time. And, like, you know, he's pointing these things out, and I'm like, okay, yeah, that sounds a little familiar. I wouldn't have noticed it, but I appreciate that he's doing it because these are those characters. That's who it is. If he continues to go back to that same well in the Shudigatwa era, then I think you have like a very valid complaint that it's just, you know, replaying the hits. But also, I feel like Murray Gold, it has enough range that he can do a lot of different styles. And I'm not saying he always does them in Doctor Who, but I feel like it felt like a little bit like coming home to me, just in a general vibe sense. And I think that was right for these particular stories, because as much as this is the new era of Doctor Who, it is not. It's yeah. not new.
I have heard his rendition of the 15th Doctor's theme in one of the BBC live performances, and it feels like it's Murray Gold stuff. So but that's just one theme out of an entire season to come. Yeah. So we will see.
I would say defer your heresy is what I was going to say, because I agree with Erica. I feel like this, if you're ever going to play the hits, that's what this whole thing is doing. So play the hits, get your Lonely Time Lord theme that's been in there since season one of 2005. Do it, right? Like, play it here, and it's a little bit different, and there's some other familiar themes there. That's all fine for this era. I think also Murray Gold, like Russell T. Davis, like, he's had a rest. He hasn't worked on this material in a while. He's probably grown and changed and has new ideas and all of that. If it all feels really samey in season one of Shudigatwa's era, I think then we know what your then your thesis is confirmed. But I don't think we can confirm anything here, because part of the point of this is to kind of play the hits. That's what I think.
For
but,
sure.
But we'll tune. There'll be a continuing check on Chip's
Chip's heresy corner.
Heresy watch.
Heresy watch. Great. That's just perfect. What have we not talked about that we should talk about this episode? I mean, there's a lot here, but we talked. Oh, our unit scientific advisor, I mentioned her only in passing, seems, with a lovely northern accent, like we're going to see a lot more of her, is my guess.
She is confirmed as a recurring character.
Yeah.
Yay.
So I assume we'll see her again. She can shoot things out of her wheelchair. And the brilliant line, a very Russell T. Davis line, we all have those.
Yep. That was so good. I loved the, and apologies for repeating something Steven said on RFS, but I thought it too, the scene where the doctor is sitting there and he's got his fancy new sonic screwdriver and he's making a screen and he's doing stuff. And I loved the way that whole scene was directed. It's him.
Oh, yeah.
And also acted, because it's him and Ritten. He's sitting there and he's looking at things and he's not muttering to himself. He's not talking. Mm-hmm. He's not going, oh my, this is, you know, this is the same doctor, but he has aged. This is a 15-year older sort of version of that same character. He's mellowed a bit. And then I love how it's directed, how she rolls up behind him and he doesn't even turn around. You know, he just says hi and she introduces herself. And it's just delightful. And I appreciate that yes, we have a character who uses a wheelchair and is super cool and competent, and I do love her accent. Ruth Madeley is just great.
Right.
And I like there's a subtle moment where she is talking to the doctor and she crosses her legs. And I just I internally cheered at that moment, because one of the common misconceptions about people who use wheelchairs is that none of them can use their legs at all. I saw somebody complaining, oh, I saw a lady in the grocery store who got up out of her wheelchair to get something off the top shelf. Well, yeah, they're a mobility aid. And I thought that was just a nice little tiny subtle touch to say, you know, this is the reality of a lot of people who use wheelchairs. You know, crossing her legs should not have been such a huge deal, but it really felt exciting and good. And then how chippy she is with the doctor. Like, she's not going to fall for any of his nonsense. And it just their vibe was really great. And I cannot wait to see more of them interacting and bouncing off of each other. I love the fact that the TARDIS is now accessible, and I can't wait to see her in there. I want more. I mean, I know we're only getting 3 episodes of this doctor and then we're on to Shurigawa, which is amazing and exciting. But I would love to see the 14th doctor and Ruth Madeley's character, which I've forgotten her name already.
Shirley Bingham.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. That's the sign of good writing, directing, acting all pulled together, is that you just want more.
Yeah. So a couple of tangents spinning off of what you just said, Erica. Number one, my wife reported that there were totally people on social media criticizing Russell T. Davis for supposedly casting an able-bodied person to play the role of someone in a wheelchair because of the leg crossing scene, which is
And that's why it's important.
Yeah. Frustrating.
Right, because she has spina bifida, I believe. And it's not everybody in a wheelchair is paralyzed from the waist down. That's not how it
absolutely
works.
And somebody and her Instagram is, you know, very open about who she is and all that. So people, imagine that, people on the internet complaining without doing their research.
Before the you other go thing to the next one, I wanted to pop on there something Erica said, which is I love the give and take with them. My favorite moment is that she tells him, because it's her job to stay away, and he hops in the back of the truck, and then they have that little nod with each other as he rolls away, where it's like, I'm not listening to you, and she's like, I know.
I get it.
Like, it's a good, she gets it. She's got her job, but she also knows who the doctor is. Okay, go ahead, Chip. Sorry.
Yeah. And the other thing, in that conversation, he talks about how he just loves Donna. And then he has that moment of recognition that do I say these things now? And his delivery of that line was absolutely Jodie Whittaker, absolutely the 13th Doctor. Mm-hmm. There are hints here that he has, even though he has been brought back to be the 10th Doctor again, people are looking for him. Even though he's the 14th, he's the 10th. He has been brought back to be David Tennant playing the Doctor. But there are little hints, and I'm eager to get even more, that he has learned from all that time spent being Matt Smith and Peter Capaldi and Jodie Whittaker.
Sure.
And those little inserts make me happy, because they are callbacks to the era that there are callbacks here to the era that just was, as well as eras before. And it's important to me as a noted Chibnall apologist.
I like that moment where they say, if you were still her, you would get it. It's just a fun moment. And I mean, we could deconstruct, like, what do men do? Men think things that women don't and all that. Like, I think there's established in the canon in the Moffat era that men, Time Lords, are often bullheaded and they regenerate into women and they're like, oh boy, I was an ass, right? Like, I think that actually does happen in the storyline, but there are ways to deconstruct that gender wise. But I just love that moment of, first off, citing Jodie Whittaker's doctor and saying, she would have gotten to the answer and you didn't. Like, you're not, you failed where she would have succeeded. I think that's a great little moment that happens, that and his remembering, I had a bow tie and then I was a Scotsman and then I was a woman, and it's, and like, there's speaking lots going of
the,
on here.
the tiny moments, the show is repeatedly saying that these changes are a good thing. You know, when the doctor is saying, oh, you know, I loved her, do I say things, yes, like that now? And immediately the response from Ruth Madeley's character, why do I keep forgetting her name?
Shirley.
Anyway, Shirley, I should remember her name from now on. Mm-hmm. Her response is, sounds like a good thing to say. And she's, yeah, just like, she delivers it kind of like deadpan, as if, yeah, like, duh.
Yeah.
And you, so, yeah, so when grown. It comes back, at the end, that it's like, you know, pointing a finger and being like, you're a male presenting Time Lord. So, yeah, you probably didn't think of this. Mm-hmm. It all sort of rolls along together.
But it's not. I know that some people who are fans, especially of Jodie Whittaker and or the Chibnall era, I am one and not really the other, but I am a fan of Jodie Whittaker. I think there were some major problems with that era, but it's not her fault. And her character is such a sparkly, shining gem. And I think there was some fear that this was going to be a retrenchment and a going backward, especially for these specials, because then the Shoot It Got was a whole other thing that's going to happen. But no, like, this episode is shouting out the previous doctor in ways that even I didn't expect, like saying, you would have figured this out if you were still her. Like, dang, right? Like, that's pretty good. And of course, I enjoy the mystery that may or may not ever be resolved, which is like, why do I have this face? And it may be to have Donna's story continue. It may just be another riff on the, why does the entire universe continue to converge on Donna Noble? I don't know, but I like the doctor grappling with those things. And in universe, it is a fun way to do it, given that the real out of universe explanation is because it's the 60th and we didn't want to launch with the new actors. So we're playing the hits for a little while. It's okay. I'm happy to hear the hits. I like the hits.
I have faith that this is not going to be a dropping the watch in the TARDIS for some future showrunner to figure it out later kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that by special three, we'll know how this happened.
Right. Or he'll reach his, this is why I did it, and now I can move on kind of moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
The sonic screwdriver I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
Because Chip mentioned Erica mentioned the he's got the confidence to kind of like call up his little holographic thing. And I'm sure, as with literally everything, somebody will complain about it. I feel like the doctor has been using the sonic screwdriver as a scanner and all sorts of things for so long now that having it actually display things in the world is actually, I think, more reasonable than looking at the end of a screwdriver and saying, oh, yes, a complete scan that I can see at the end of this screwdriver. I know it's a new thing. I thought it was really clever and fun. His building of force field walls that he slides around so that they can escape. I thought that was just, again, we can harp on the canon and it's just a screwdriver and all of that, but like it was cool. It was a how does the doctor solve a problem to bring people to safety in the middle of a firefight? And the answer is building these force field walls and sliding them around. And that moment where he slides the one wall out and then gets out there and pushes it forward, I'm like, it's like I'm watching a cartoon, except it's real. Like, I love, yep. I thought it was really fun.
Good miming too.
Yes.
The pedantic Doctor Who fan, of which there are many, will say, okay, so in this future episode, he could have just made a force field and he didn't. Why didn't he? The Doctor Who fan that Russell T. Davis is after doesn't give a care because it was cool in the moment.
Not to go back to Russell T. Davis's first episode, but one of the things that made me realize I'm going to love this guy and the writing he does is in Rose, they're above the pool of the Auton plastic center intelligence. And he literally takes out a test tube and says, anti-plastic. Like, and you're like, okay, like, anti-plastic is the answer. Like, just go with it. This is what we're doing here. Just, you're here for the ride. And this is also the guy who did Psychic Paper to eliminate all the tedium of past Doctor Who episodes where they killed a lot of time by having to check on the credentials of the uncredentialed time travelers. He's like, forget about that psychic paper.
This is the same showrunner who had Sarah Jane magic up a warp stored diamond that could blow up all of the Daleks out of nowhere in the Stolen Earth and Journey's End.
Yeah.
This is the same guy who had the Master revived by a potion in the End of Time, you know, things like that. He's going to make shortcuts that go too far, but you're right. He's also the anti-plastic guy. And, and this episode really, he puts his stamp on it again and says, remember me, I'm back. Don't you love me?
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that he did that I wanted to make sure that we mentioned is just, I adored the trans representation. I knew it was going to be there. I love Yasmin Finney. Heartstoppers is great. If you haven't watched it, it's just super sweet. You should check it out. And it's interesting because Rose Noble here is very like styled almost exactly the same as her character in Heartstoppers. So it was a little hard for me to be like, no, this is not that character. This is this character. At first, and then seeing her like some of the Doctor Who Unleashed and behind the scenes stuff, she's styled very differently. So I was like, you really just decided to just go full force and just do that same character styling. But I thought, you know, honestly, the most important reaction to that part of the story is the reaction of trans people. From what I have seen amongst my group of friends, lots of feelings, lots of tears, lots of joy. But also, I really appreciated the scene where Sylvia is like, she gets clumsy and she messes it up. And it's just like, I feel like that is such an important thing to see for people who are trying, for their friends, for their children, for their family members who are trans, and they're trying to be an ally and trying to learn. I loved that it wasn't like hanging a lantern on it and making it a very special episode of Doctor Who. It was just, this is a part of life. We have this beautiful and wonderful girl, and we're trying to support her in the best way that we can, and we're working on it. I cried.
Even Sylvia's, I mean, what's brilliant about that scene, and it's just so well done by Russell, is that Sylvia is coming at it from a place of love, and but realizing that she's done it wrong. And I one of the things I love about Russell and all of his work, and if people haven't seen the stuff that he's done since he left Doctor Who, he's done some of the best work of his career in that time. Just seriously, some of the best work of his career. That moment is something that, you know, you could. He has what we said before, right? Which is like, he just thinks he's right, and he's just going to do it the way he thinks is right. Mm-hmm. And so what he's doing here is like, you could get all offended that there is a dead name and that there's misgendering by Sylvia. The dead name's by the crappy people from school. Right. Mm-hmm. And then Sylvia does a misgendering, and I'm sure you could get up in arms about it and all that, but like the point that he's making there is that there are people who love you, people who are going to make mistakes. And the important thing is that their heart's in the right place, that they're trying, and that they're learning. And that's what that scene with Sylvia very quickly establishes, I think, kind of beautifully. And then coming from Donna, right, her mother, nothing but fierce support for her child. Mm-hmm. I think
I will both descend. Of those,
yes. Yeah, seeing both of those in that moment is so powerful and so great, and is definitely Russell T. Davis's statement on the matter. It's it's really well done. It's good to see people, trans people, reacting this way, and also it's a message for people who have, you know, friends and family and other loved ones. The you know, seeing that Sylvia gets it wrong, but she's working on it and trying to do better and has genuine love for her granddaughter regardless. I we mentioned Sylvia, like that's part of the family dynamic here. Russell does this so well, right? He did it so well with Rose and her mom too. Sylvia is often placed in opposition, but it's because she is fiercely defending her daughter, and there's that funny moment where Donna's like, oh, you know, you have a child and she grows up and she's not quite what you expect, but you still love her, right, mom? And like, there's that great moment, but like the fact is Sylvia has been protecting her from the doctor because she knows that the doctor has said, I'm dangerous. It would be bad for your daughter. And that I love seeing that actress again. I love seeing that character again. I think that she comes off really well doing what she needs to do. And early on, she was portrayed as being more of an obstacle. But she really has grown as the defender of her daughter, and that's wonderful. And then also we get the dangling out there Wilf moment of like, well, I'm sorry for your loss. And they're like, he's not dead, you idiot. He's in his 90s. He can't go upstairs. He's in unit has put him in a home somewhere, right? And it's like just a Donna family dynamics. And Sean, who we saw, and they use in that opening bit, we see their wedding. Like, that's all just, it was nice to see them again. And I thought that all those moments were really well handled.
Yep. Oh, I want to talk about, usually I am the person who doesn't like the wacky comedy in Doctor Who. It just tends to go too far and it's not my favorite thing. And yet, when you put Rachel Talalay in the driver's seat for a scene, along with the editor who did Heaven Sent with her, I am blanking on his name. But like, you put those two in charge of a wacky comedy scene and suddenly I am 100% on board, because the sequence where Donna has just found the meep. She comes in the house. It's clinging onto her leg. The doctor is trying to come in the front door. Sylvia is saying, you're not seeing anything. This isn't happening. Every single beat of that was edited perfectly. There was no wasted time. Every shot was just right. And then at the very, very end, it ends with just the meep saying, meep, meep, and you cut away. It was like it was like something out of the Sandbaggers from the 1970s. It was just perfectly, perfectly paced. And I found myself loving it and was very surprised. I was hats off to everybody involved in that.
When he gets punched and there's the reverse shot where he's reacting to getting punched and while he's basically looking at the camera says, oh, here we go. Right. Like it's like this again. Yeah, it's just really excellently executed, right? It's action, but it's comedy action, and yeah, it was good stuff.
Is it ever a podcast about Doctor Who without a reference to the Sandbaggers? I'm just asking.
Probably not.
I can't help myself. It's so good. Everybody should watch it. Chip, but they should also be watching Doctor Who.
Sure. Chip, do you have any other final things we haven't covered?
No, I think I'm good. I think I'm very good. I got to watch Doctor Who with favorite characters coming back, side by side with my spouse, who's back in the fold after a few years in the wilderness, and it just feels like a new beginning. And I'm excited for next week in Wild Blue Yonder for sure.
Yeah, it's the idea that there's this little mini season happening in front of us is really fun. I admit to have fantasized for a long time about the idea that why couldn't you do a little mini series with a past doctor and just do it? And the argument was always, well, people get confused if there are too many doctors around, and I think that's funny because that's exactly what we're living through now, where they're like, Shuri Gatwa shows up in a lot of the iconography for the series, and they made a point of showing him in the trailer, like want you to remember that he is coming. And it does feel a little weird because we're watching a show that is just this temporary bit before the new show really starts. On another hand, I think I would feel uneasy if they had just said, oh, David Tennant is just going to come back for a while, because it would feel like the show's going backward. And that's not what this is. This is like a little moment to remember and enjoy that part of that era. But I know that it's just temporary and that we're going to continue moving forward soon. And that makes me feel better about it, I think.
I have a wacky, wild prediction.
Oh, here we are. Prediction corner. Erica's prediction corner. All right. Let's get in the corner now.
Yep. Everybody huddle. Huddle in the corner.
All right.
I think they have been so tight-lipped about what this next episode is going to be. We have the giggle is the third one, and we've seen some like shots for that. But this next one, we have nothing. And my guess is that they might do a thing that I've wanted them to do forever, and that they made us think that they were going to do in The Next Doctor, where it turned out that was not The Next Doctor at all. I wonder if Shuri Gatwa actually shows up in the next episode in Wild Blue Yonder. And it's a multi-doctor story
from the other
side of this, in the middle of this 60th anniversary celebration, and so that Shuri Gatwa actually gets to be a part of it. And then, you know, he goes off, and then the giggle is just the 14th Doctor and Donna again. But that is my wacky wild prediction, and I hope it's right. If it's not, then, you know, that's fine. But I think that would be super cool. And in one of the, I've watched so much background stuff. I watched Doctor Who Unleashed. I watched the behind the scenes stuff on YouTube, which I liked better. And the commentary. Somewhere in all of that, Russell T. Davis says that they do something that has never been done in the history of Doctor Who. I think that's it. That's my guess.
I don't know about next week, but in watching all of the trailers, I have had that sense, right, that they're going to – they have a new doctor on deck. How would you not try to integrate him at some point? That's not just the last scene of the last episode. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would love to see that.
The only reason I'm guessing it's this middle one, which feels a little bit awkward, is simply because they have not told us anything about it. They have not shown almost anything from it, whereas we've gotten a bunch more from the Giggle. I feel like it would make more sense for it to be the Giggle, but hey, RTD does what he does.
Right.
I would love that if for no other reason that it would be just the biggest handing over of the baton that Doctor Who has ever
yes.
done.
And it rarely ever happens where you can do this because you never have the next Doctor cast while you're doing episodes with a previous, I mean, it's a current / previous Doctor. So this is the time if you're ever going to do it.
We did get a forehead.
I know. We got the eyebrows.
I mean, that's true. Yep.
But it wasn't really interacting, right?
One of the reasons why people have always said, no, that's a terrible thing to do is because it is disrespectful to the outgoing Doctor. But in this case, that Doctor got his outgoing celebrations multiple times at this point. So why not?
No, it is the perfect time for it. Well, I do hope that happens because that would be a great baton passing. Because although I think that in some circles, in some audience levels, and maybe even in, I would say, in the U.S. more broadly, Matt Smith is the hit Doctor of the new series. Yep. Mm-hmm. David Tennant overall feels like a comfort Doctor.
He is. He's my comfort Doctor.
Yeah, and to have him be present at the baton passing and let them interact in a classic multi-Doctor story kind of way a little bit would be a blast, right? And then you would see Shuti Gatwa in his season and be like, well, of course, we've already seen him. We know who he's going to be. He was with David Tennant. We get it. That's awesome. And that would be cool. Erica, I'm going to one-up you a little bit, which is what if Shuti Gatwa's interaction in, let's say, next week's episode, because that's what you're saying here. What if, to get a little bit twisty, it is also connected to a story in next season?
Yes. Oh, I love it, Jason. High five.
I mean, it's more Stephen Moffat move than RTD, but Russell will surprise you sometimes. Yep. So I don't know. So much. Okay, we've blown past the runtime of this episode, which is very
sorry.
Us.
We're out of practice.
Hey, team, how about we get back together next week and watch another episode of Doctor Who? What do you say?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. The Doctor Who Flashcast will return. I mean, we did, but we'll return again. Next time for Wild Blue Yonder, whatever that means. I don't know. Erica's laid her cards on the table. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
So until then, I'd like to thank Chip Sutterth from the 2 Minute Time Lord podcast. Thank you, Chip.
TWOMinuteTimeLord.com. Shameless shilling because I'm not on Twitter anymore.
Plug away. And Erica Ensign from many podcasts, including Verity, and I guess I should say Lazy Doctor Who, an excellent podcast at The Incomparable as well. Thank you.
LazyDoctorWho.com.
Excellent. And I'm me, Jason Snell. Thank you for listening. Oh, the Doctor Who Flashcast. Thank you for listening and coming back after a long time with this feed being very sleepy. We're back, baby. yeah, that's right. Get the dagger drive going. On second thought, don't. And until next week, meet me. Doctor Who Flashcast on the air.